This is the book of Genesis, chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. Now the Lord said to Abram, Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
Deserves the clap. Our next reading comes from someone a bit older. And he's going to read to us from Isaiah chapter 60.
Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples. But the Lord will arise upon you, and his glory will be seen upon you. And nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising.
Thank you. I think the next reading will not clap. It's a consultant psychiatrist reading, so I think it's less important.
The following reading is from Gospel of Matthew, chapter 2. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he who has been born, King of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and has come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him, and assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, and by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word, then I too may come and worship him. After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them, until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way.
Everybody gets a clap at Christmas.
Good to add my welcome to Bill's. My name's Tim Davis, to say hello to you, those of you I've not met before. I'm the overall leader here at Christ Church Centre. It's great to welcome you if you're a member of someone's family and you're here for Christmas, or if you've not been to church for a while and a friend has brought you along this evening. It's great to welcome you. And I do want to thank each of our readers, and I want to thank our musicians as well. Let's give a round of applause to our fantastic musicians. Okay, I just want to share some thoughts from that famous Christmas reading that Daniel read for us a moment ago, the visit of the wise men to Jesus. And I've got a couple of questions I want to we'll perhaps throw out to you. And so at various points I'm looking for some interaction and some engagement. So if I ask a question and I look lost, just say something to help me. Okay. I just want to begin by thinking a little bit about democracy. Democracy may be all the rage, but kings and queens and the monarchy as an idea is still very popular. Royalty plays a vital role in some of our favourite stories. And so, a picture is just coming up on the screen now. Who's that? Interactive time. Robin Hood, that's right, that is Robin Hood. Robin Hood is a great hero. He's a hero who puts wrongs to right, isn't he? He puts wrongs to right. But who is Robin's hero? Who does Robin think will one day come and put all wrongs to right? Who? What's the title of the guy who's going to put all wrongs to right, the great Robin hero? He's a king, isn't he? King Richard the Lionheart. That's absolutely right. You see, in a story like Robin Hood, the king plays an absolute goody. He will come and put all things right for everybody. So, on the one hand, we're a little bit down on democracy, but in our stories, we love democracy. Just to summarise, kings and queens with real power are popular in stories. That little summary sentence is up there on the screen. Kings and queens with real power are popular in stories. Well, what about kings and queens in real life? Who is this a picture of? That's the Queen, that's right. That is Queen who? Great. Well, fantastic. Top of the clock. Queen Elizabeth II. Spot on. Queen Elizabeth II is different to royalty in stories. Number one, she's real. She's a real queen. But she's different in another sense as well, is she doesn't really have real power, does she? Does she really? Be honest. Yeah, I mean, the Australians had a vote. They voted to keep her, and they still think that they live under a monarchy, but they've actually voted for her now, so really she's head of state, and they voted for her, so she's not really, in that sense, a proper monarch in Australia anymore, is she? Yes. Well, the Brits think yes. She's a real queen who doesn't have real power. To be honest, some people like the royal family and some people aren't so keen on the royal family. So just to summarise, real kings and queens, certainly in Britain, don't have real power and they're not popular with everybody. Okay? So here's a question. You don't have to answer this one. This is to ponder on. How do we react to the idea of a real king in real life with real power? How do we react to the idea that somebody has absolute authority over you and me as their subject? Are we attracted to that or not? Christmas, according to the Bible, is about the birth of just such a king. A king with real power and who is a real living person. A real king with real power. And the first thing I want to draw out from that great story of the visit of the wise men is this, and the titles have come up on the screen up there. Christmas is about the birth of the world's king. Christmas is about the birth of the world's king. Matthew, the beginning of Matthew's gospel, and some of us here at Christchurch Central have been looking at Matthew's gospel over the last two or three weeks, the first chapter of it. Matthew chapter 1 tells us how Jesus is rooted in history. Great genealogy starts the gospel. He is rooted in history. But we also hear that he originated in heaven. The virgin birth is what then Matthew moved on to next. Here in chapter 2, in the visit of the wise man, we find out that Jesus, that Christmas, is relevant to us all. It is the birth of the world's king. Let me explain. Jesus was born to be, as we heard in our reading that Daniel read for us, he was born to be King of the Jews. King of the Jews. So what is it with these men who come from a long way off, from a distant country, a foreign country? They are not Jews. What are they doing coming and looking to worship and to serve the King of the Jews? Well, these wise men fulfill some ancient prophecies in the Bible. There's one just coming up on the screen, it says this, we heard it earlier on. And nations, that is nations, the world, people of the world, shall come to your light, speaking of the coming king, and kings to the brightness of your rising. You'll be the brightest star in the sky, and other bright kings will look to you. They shall bring gold and frankincense. That's interesting, isn't it? They shall bring gold and frankincense and shall bring good news, the praises of the Lord. Christmas is about the birth of the world's king. And Ollie, one of our apprentices, has kind of helped me with some visual effects here. Now, here's how we might summarise visually Jesus' rule. Here is a summary in picture form of Jesus' rule over the world there. Jesus, the king, the crown, ruling over the real world, the globe. A real king over the real world. A real king with real power over the real world. The wise men are sometimes called magi, which to our mind, certainly if you're British, sounds like magician. They studied the stars. They arrived from the east with some precious spices. They are, again, to a Western mindset, very exotic. They sound exotic people. They come from an exotic place, delivering and bringing exotic gifts. And so we give them exotic names, Melchior, Caspar, and Balthazar, which you'll notice in our reading earlier on don't appear in the Bible. We give them three names, even though the Bible never mentions that there were three kings or three wise men. We just hear that there were three gifts. It may well be, actually, that if Jesus arrived nowadays, that these folks would appear from different parts of the world and they'd have names like Rebiao and Bill and Tony and Jeff and Ollie. Maybe not so exotic, but you get the picture. These wise men represented the world that wasn't Jewish. This was the world coming to serve the Jewish king, who was in actual fact the king for the whole world. Jesus, Christmas, is about the birth of the world's king. So how do we respond to the real king who has real power? Well, for some, and this is the second thing I just want to draw out from this story, Christmas is actually about rejecting our king. Christmas is about rejecting our king. We heard about Herod. Herod, when he heard about the birth of Jesus, was deeply, deeply troubled. And we're told that the whole of Jerusalem was troubled with him. Well, if the king's troubled and there's trouble brewing, then the city was in a bit of turmoil as well. Herod was a usurper to the throne. He was a bit like a John, Prince John in Robin Hood. He wasn't really and shouldn't have been in charge. It's no wonder that when he heard about the birth of the real king, he gets uptight. No wonder he's upset. No wonder he's angry. The birth of Jesus, the king of the Jews, and hearing that there are men coming from across the world to visit Jesus, was a serious threat to King Herod. It was a threat to him personally, and it was a serious threat to his rule. What's intriguing about Herod is the way that he rejects the rule of Jesus, though. It's quite intriguing. He doesn't just kind of like reject it outright or go and search for Jesus to do him some harm, which come back next week, next Sunday, and you'll hear about that. But Herod is interesting. He knows where to find the answers to his questions. You remember the story? How he got around him the best Bible teachers, the best scholars in the land, and he got them searching the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, to find out where the birth of the Messiah, the Christ, was going to be. See, Herod knew exactly where to go for the answers that he wanted to the Bible. And he knew the right people to ask to get the answers to his questions. The other thing about Herod is that when he hears from his great scholars as to where Jesus is going to be born or the Messiah should have been born, he actually demonstrates that he trusts the Bible. He trusted that the Bible was reliable, this ancient prophecy of the past. So he sends the wise men on their way to search for Jesus in the town of Bethlehem. So he knew where to find answers to his questions, the Bible, and he trusted the Bible, what the Bible had to say. And not only that, he knew the right thing to do when he found Jesus. He actually said to the wise men, that I may worship him. He knew where to get the answers, he trusted the Bible, and he knew what to do. That is, worship King Jesus. Herod does all the right things in order to do the wrong thing. He does all the right things in order to reject Jesus. Quite fascinating, isn't it? That's Herod's response to the birth of the world's king. How do we respond? How do we respond at Christmas time? Well, I've related the idea of royalty and monarchy to various folks, and I remember once watching a television discussion led by David Dimbleby, and it was about the monarchy. And a man in the audience said this. He said this to David Dimbleby: "Stop calling us subjects. I'm not a subject. I'm a citizen. Stop calling us subjects. I'm not a subject. I'm a citizen." I sometimes written to friends encouraging them to consider Christianity, and here's a reply that I got from a friend of mine, again on the whole area of submitting to a ruler. This is what I received in my post. "I don't reject God, but I do live life my own way, and it's a good way, so rarely does anyone any harm. The idea of, quote, submitting to a ruler is really rather quaint. It's outdated and silly," said my friend in his letter to me. It seems, thinking about David Dimbleby program and my friend who wrote to me, it seems that we often like the idea of being good citizens, living good lives, and not doing anyone else any harm. But the idea of being a subject, of submitting to a ruler, is another matter. I wonder, are we guilty of perhaps being tempted to do all the right things in order to do the wrong thing? To look at our lives and to say, yes, I'm being a good citizen. I'm sure if God was to be watching me now, or if I was to die now and go and meet him on his throne in heaven, he'd say, oh, well done, you've been a good citizen. I look like I'm doing the right thing. But in actual fact, what I'm really doing as well at the same time is doing the right thing to look like I'm doing the right thing in order actually to keep Jesus at arm's length. The idea of submitting to him and him encroaching into every area of my life, I'd really rather not have that. Do we think, well, why is it that we think these ways? Do we think that God's not on our side, so we'd rather keep him outside of our sphere of friends, and we'd like to keep him at bay when it comes to our work? Do we believe that God has perhaps got it in for us? That God's not got our best interests at heart? That God's ways for us to live and to think are bound to be bad for us? Why is it that we often prefer to keep God's rule away from ourselves? That God will make life boring, that God will cramp my style, that God will stop me being me? Do we genuinely think that we'll be better off without God? That if we don't reject him outright, then we'll certainly be wise to keep him at a distance and perhaps think of him once or twice a year? Do we think that if God takes over, he's going to take away? Is that why King Jesus can sometimes be a threat to us, if he's going to come as our ruler? I've got another picture on here that perhaps summarises a little bit of the way we may live our lives. Quietly getting on with doing our own thing, not doing anybody any harm, but at the end of the day, we've got our own little name written into our crown, like Dave and Pete there, who are sat on their thrones that for a moment seemed to have disappeared. Why do we think that God might be a threat to us, or Jesus may be a threat to us? We'll come back next week and think a little bit more about Herod and where his rejection of the Lord Jesus took him. Let's focus again on this Christmas story. Here's the alternative to rejecting the rule of King Jesus. And the summary is coming up on the screen there. Christmas, the birth of Jesus, it is about worshipping our King. That's the alternative to rejecting him. It seems contrary to the world, contrary to the word on the street, contrary sometimes to public perception, contrary perhaps to the private fears that we have in our hearts, the concerns and the reservations we may have there. Receiving Jesus our King is actually extremely good, profoundly good. The wise men that came to Jesus, to visit Jesus, they went right out their way. They travelled perhaps hundreds of miles to come and visit him. They made every effort to get to meet this new child, the birth of the world's King. And as they got nearer to their destination, you might remember from our reading, I'll just repeat it for you, because it's quite an interesting phrase. As they headed on their way to Bethlehem, having met with Herod, we're told this: they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. They rejoiced with exceeding great joy. It doesn't just say they rejoiced. It doesn't just say they had exceeding great joy. It says they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. It emphasizes the point. We might be tempted to think of God's rule as a suppressant, but Matthew is quite clear that King Jesus' rule is an anti-suppressant. The rule of King Jesus actually leads to a multiplication of joy, rejoiced with exceeding great joy. It bubbles along. It multiplies joy. It's a wonderful thing, a fantastic thing. As Bill, who's leading this evening, said the other day when a few of us were looking at this passage, it says, you know, meeting and worshipping Jesus is kind of high fives all round. These guys are happy to go on their way to see Jesus. We know where he is. Let's go and see him. They were glad to live with the thought of the coming of the King of the world. And so perhaps this is a better picture of what it is to live under the rule of Jesus, coming up on the screen here. There you are. Four very happy people, not with their own names in the crown, but with Jesus as their ruler. Rejoicing, happy, contented, knowing the natural fact God has got our best interests at heart. His way of living for us is the best way of living. As someone once said, the way of most holiness is the way of most happiness. It's a glad thing to do, a wonderful thing to do. And what about their gifts? What about the gifts that these wise men bought? Based on the carol, we often relate to the gold that Jesus was brought by these wise men. Relate that to royalty, king forever. We relate frankincense to Jesus being God. Deity nigh, says the carol that talks about frankincense, the verse that talks about frankincense. And myrrh we relate to Jesus' death, sorrowing, sighing, bleeding, dying. And in one sense, why not? Those are true of Jesus. Those are the things that were true of him and what he came to do. But in Old Testament times, and Matthew's Gospel, the context is the Old Testament, gold and spices were simply the most expensive and valuable commodities. And so, first of all, these wise men bought gold. I just want a volunteer to come and help me at the front. I've got something really very small for you to hold. Sam, do you want to come to the front and help me? I can see your hand going up a little bit. Sam, will you just come and stand next to me there? And you hold up that little coin there. You'll see it. You'll hold it under the light there so folks can see it. You'll see that little coin there. It's a similar size coin to the coin that I've got in my hand here. Can you have a look at your coin? Has it got a picture on it, has it? Of Queen? Mine's got Queen Elizabeth. Who's yours got on it? Someone you don't recognise. Bill might recognise it. You know, ask Bill Fernhuff who that might be on there. Bill's been around a little bit longer. Who's on there, Bill?
Queen Victoria.
Queen Victoria. And what's the date on it? What's the date under her name? Under her face?
1872.
1872, yes. Queen Victoria, 1872. Mine's Queen Elizabeth, and I think it's 2003 or something like that, if I could read it. Much more recent. There you are. 1993. These two coins there, they're similar size, aren't they? Hold that one again. The question is, the coin that Sam's got in his hand and the coin I've got in my hand, which one do you think is more valuable? Yeah. You think the one that Sam's got is more valuable. How much more valuable do you think the one that Sam has is in his hand than mine? Oh, Bill's giving you an over-top estimate there. Anyone want to have a little kind of guess as to how much more? Sorry? 119 times more. Stuart is right. Sam, thank you. The reason why I asked Sam Bronson to come out is because he didn't run out the door with it. I would have been in big trouble. This little coin is more than 100 times the value of this coin. And it's going back in my pocket. Gold has an intrinsic value. And that's what these fellows brought to Jesus. Got something else here as well. Who else? Who wants to come up and... I'll walk down the middle. Here.
You like some of that? Not that. Oh, you're right. Smell like your mum's perfume?
No.
Smell like that? What's that? It's not bad, is it? Frankincense, that's right. Yeah, some of you are with it. There you are.
Frankincense. We know a little bit about frankincense. People still use frankincense a little bit nowadays. But again, that was just a very valuable spice commodity that came in from the East. Now, this is a little bit different. This is myrrh. We know a little bit less about myrrh, and myrrh's got a
different smell to it. You'll smell that. Nothing, eh? Nothing you smell at all. Nice smell. James, you
all right?
Any of you smell myrrh? Yeah. What, this afternoon?
Myrrh is interesting. I kind of quite like the smell of myrrh. I could get addicted to that one. It's really quite good. See, we often relate myrrh to the death and the burial of the Lord Jesus Christ. Again, it's a very, very valuable little oil, that one. Yet in the Old Testament, myrrh, the most times it mentions actually is in a book called Song of Songs. A Song of Songs is the most fabulous love song in the Old Testament. And it talks about a young woman putting perfume on and dripping with myrrh. This is the Chanel number 5. I know you didn't believe me. Chanel number 5 of the ancient world here. That's my wife sorted for Christmas. I don't know where Conrad's gone. I was going to say, the wise men didn't turn up at the petrol station to buy their gifts on their way. They thought about things carefully before they headed off. Some women are laughing very uncomfortably because you know that the man in your life has just remembered he's got to go to the petrol station tomorrow. These folks bought the most valuable commodities of their day, and they're commodities that natural fact, if we go back into the Old Testament, The Old Testament begins, you know, God strikes out on this most fantastic friendship with his people. And he says to them, way back in the book of Exodus, he says, to summarize it, he says, I will be your God, and you will be my people. And together we will show the world how good it is to have God as your God. And that kind of like figured out, not so well at points, but at other points it really began to show. And so during the reign of King Solomon, the great Queen of Sheba came to visit Solomon. She'd heard about how well he was running the nation. And she, we hear about in 1 Kings 10, brought Solomon gold and spices. And she's basically said to Solomon, it's even better than I heard. It is fabulous to have God as your God. And you've shown the world how good it is to have God as your God. So we come to the idea of a real king in real life ruling over our lives. And we can be so down on it and so negative and wonder, well, do I really want God running my life? We think of it so negatively. But Christmas is about remembering actually how precious and how wonderful it is to give the living God all of our lives, to let him take over every area of our hearts, and to know in that ultimate and wonderful joy. So perhaps we need to change our minds about submitting to the rule of God's King Jesus, to see him and his rule not as a threat, but as a delight. Not as a killjoy, but like the wise men, to rejoice in him with exceeding great joy. Perhaps we need to stop keeping Jesus at a safe distance, worrying that if we allow him too close, he'll seriously take away. How can you add God to someone's life and them to be a loser? It's impossible, isn't it? Add God, he's going to be a winner. And like the wise men and their gifts, to honour, to worship the Lord Jesus in the most worthy, valuable way we can, which is with our entire lives.